This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. Guy Edward Bartkus is the 25-year-old suspect police have now identified in connection with yesterday's car explosion outside a California fertility clinic. They're now going through the writings Bartkus may have left, indicating possible plans for a separate attack later this week. Palm Springs Police Chief Andy Mills speaking moments ago.
We were able to save all of the embryos at this facility. Good guys one, bad guys zero.
A Mexican Navy training ship slammed into New York City's Brooklyn Bridge yesterday. At least two people were killed in the incident and more than a dozen others injured, some seriously. Mayor Eric Adams praised first responders and sailors at the scene.
The coordination was extremely important and it was executed to the best of our ability to minimize any loss of life.
Authorities say the boat lost power before the incident. This is ABC News. The Israeli military is stepping up its ground operation in the Gaza Strip, conducting a preliminary wave of airstrikes on at least 670 targets. The Palestinian Health Ministry, run by Hamas, says more than 160 Palestinians were killed in the activity yesterday. The increased violence in the Middle East is putting New York City on high alert this afternoon. The NYPD using metal detectors to screen spectators at the annual Israel Day parade. Alongside other lawmakers, Governor Kathy Hochul marched in the parade, noting she visited Israel after the October 7th attack nearly 2 years ago.
Never in the wildest dreams did I think that 589 days later there'd still be 60 hostages waiting to come home, some alive and some have not made it.
Seven fugitives are still on the run more than 2 days after escaping from a New Orleans jail. Authorities there say 10 men initially broke out. They've since recaptured three. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
My perfect day has sand, salt, water, and friends. But my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can take me out of the moment. Now I'm all in with clearer skin thanks to Skyrizi. Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. With Skyrizi, most people saw 90% clearer skin and many were even 100% plaque-free at 4 months. Skyrizi is just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions, increased infections, or lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor about any flu-like symptoms or vaccines.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin. And that means everything.
Nothing is everything.
Ask your doctor about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. Visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and data shows Wisconsin kids are in crisis. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The report from the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health shows the numbers have increased dramatically over the past 10 years. While rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm, and suicidal thoughts went up across the board, girls saw an overall higher increase. Wisconsin boys, however, are 2 to 4 times more likely to die by suicide than girls, according to the report. Amy Marsman says these trends are worse for LGBTQ+ students and students of color.
They feel less connected to their school and less likely to report that they feel they belong at their school. So we know that there are target populations that we should really focus on.
Marsman says teens are also getting less sleep than ever before, which is foundational to their mental health. More than 20% of teens reported self-harm and nearly 25% of girls reported seriously considering suicide, according to the report. Marsman says factors like rising food insecurity, particularly among students of color, also play a significant role. She says additional support during the pandemic helped to eliminate food insecurity gaps, but now Black kids in Wisconsin are 5 times more likely to be hungry than white kids.
Some of these everyday situations really impact youth mental health, whether you're getting enough sleep, whether you are getting enough to eat, whether there's financial stability in your household. All of those are factors, and they are disproportionately impacting kids of color.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly sunny skies for your Sunday. Light north winds and afternoon highs in the upper 60s. Tonight, a few clouds around the area. A northeast breeze and morning lows in the lower 40s. On Monday, clouds and some showers. Highs near 60. Right now, it's 55.
Maggie Dawn.
At 4:30, I'm joined by Benga Ajilore, a former advisor with the USDA, talking about the threats to rural hospitals posed by the Republican budget reconciliation.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6. This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host. Yes, that's right, your host for this hour and also the second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, I am delighted and I am honored that you have chosen to spend some of your important and precious time this weekend in conversation, in engagement with me and some of the major stories. And there are a lot of them, as always, in the areas of government and law and the delivery of justice in America, the rule of law in particular. As always, we take our name here on this broadcast, Amicus, from the Latin, from the legal term, which means friend. And indeed, indeed, one of the news stories coming out of just this past week, this major Supreme Court oral argument. During the course of that oral argument, Justice Gorsuch looked at one of the litigants, one of the lawyers appearing in front of him, and said, "I need all the amici," which is plural for amicus, "I can get." He said, "I need all the friends I can get, all the legal advice, all the legal support I can possibly get." We would like to take Justice Gorsuch up on his commitment to that and also serve as the amicus, the amici for you as well. Indeed, one of the important stories that we're going to be talking about at length in this edition of Amicus, a Law Review, is this major oral argument of just this past week. It extended well beyond 2 hours. It was scheduled for 1 hour before the Supreme Court. They went almost 2 hours with three different lawyers arguing about, yes, that's right, birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. I'm going to get back to that to tell you a little bit more about where that comes from, why this is percolating up, to use another word that was much in the debate this past week. How did this come about? How is it that we are now talking once again about what the 14th Amendment means, and not the language of the 14th Amendment guarantees due process and equal protection, all those other wonderful and good things that animate our nation, but instead looking to the very first phrases of that amendment to the Constitution, ratified July 9th, 1868, after the Civil War. We're going to talk about what it means today, apparently, according to the President of the United States of America, contrary to what every federal judge has found, in opposition to what our president says that means. And again, wrestling with that issue a bit before the Supreme Court this past week. The big takeaway there, and we'll go into a deeper dive on exactly what some of the justices were concerned about, what they weren't concerned about just this past week. The big story, however, the big takeaway is no clear resolution from their comments, their questions about how they would underscore and address the underlying issue here, which is whether or not birthright citizenship means what it says and says what it means. And if you are born in the country, born in our United States of America, if you are entitled to citizenship, the president attempting to carve out some exceptions to that. We'll talk about what his executive order said. Instead, the big takeaway from the oral argument, again, lasting 2 hours, lots of important questions back and forth, lots of hypotheticals, as always, focusing on practical things. All of that premised upon this baseline question about whether a judges in this particular instance and in others across the country can impose what are called nationwide injunctions. Can a single federal district court judge issue a judgment, issue an opinion, and make that applicable across the nation? If you are in the Northern District of Texas, the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Washington, all of which we have seen produce various orders, can that singular federal judge issue an order based upon what she or he determines to be the law and the facts that is applicable to every other jurisdiction in the nation? That was the focus of the overwhelming period of time during which the Supreme Court was addressing just this past week the last oral argument of this term, the issue of birthright citizenship. We'll talk more about what they said. Lots of interesting things back and forth. And again, coming from Justice Gorsuch, on behalf of all of the judges, I need all the amici I can get. I need all the friends I can get in terms of understanding this particular question of nationwide jurisdiction, nationwide, countrywide injunctions. Lots of things to say about that. We're going to get into that in great detail. The other major event happening almost at the same time that our United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. is addressing whether or not the president's executive order can accept and can be pursued nationwide, get that acceptance of nationwide applicability. At the same time, Wisconsin Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan, right here in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, in another federal courtroom, hers before a magistrate judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, downtown Milwaukee, 517 East Wisconsin Avenue. It is that miraculous, amazing building right there on Wisconsin Avenue. I suspect many of you have been there, certainly seen it, if not gone in to take in what is your federal courthouse. It is not the property of judges. It's not the property of U.S. attorneys. It is your property. In the midst of all of this activity in Washington, D.C., simultaneously with that, we have what's called an arraignment and a plea hearing. And it comes in the wake, as you know, of the indictment by a federal grand jury of Wisconsin Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan. We'll talk about what happened at that hearing, that arraignment and plea hearing. We'll talk about the scheduling, yes, of a trial date, which will probably not stick. And significantly, we're going to talk about something that happened not only in connection with the indictment. Why did that happen? Why is it necessary under the Constitution for a grand jury to determine whether or not there's probable cause here? What's that all about? But we'll significantly talk about the importance of something else that happened in the hours before this arraignment, but immediately after the return by the grand jury of this indictment. We're going to talk about a motion, a request, a petition filed by the lawyers who are representing Judge Hannah Dugan. We'll talk about the two bases upon which they are now asking already, right out of the gate. They're asking the federal trial judge, it's been assigned to Lynn Edelman. He's a district court judge, a trial judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, long tenured. I appeared in front of him, as do many other civil and criminal litigants on a regular basis, assigned to him for pretrial processing, pretrial administration, and ultimately the trial of this case, if it gets that far. The significant other rule of law news just this past week is the filing by the attorneys who are representing defendant Hannah Dugan of a major motion to dismiss, asking that the judge, the court, Judge Edelman, dismiss this case outright, even before we get to anything further about the merits, before we address anything about the relationship between the statutes that are invoked in that indictment and the specific facts set forth in the complaint and in that indictment, finding that there's a basis, according to the defense counsel, for the judge to dismiss the case based upon the fact that she is immune from prosecution. Where have we heard that word before? And indeed, invoking the very rules and principles that the Supreme Court articulated about 11 months ago in that major catastrophic ruling involving immunities that attend a sitting president, that immunity position now used in this context, asking the judge to dismiss this case on the basis that Judge Hannah Dugan is immune from prosecution based upon the courtroom activities alleged in the indictment. And secondarily, federalism. Federalism acquires, again, that civics that you all have. It goes back to the 10th Amendment. That 10th Amendment says that power is not delegated to the federal government, to the United States, by the Constitution, by this very document, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. That's the 10th Amendment. That's the federalism under which our system works, invoking both of those principles, immunities and federalism. The attorneys for Hannah Dugan have filed a motion now pending, even before the arraignment of this past week, now pending in front of the magistrate judge, now pending in front of the district court judge for resolution, asking that the court, petitioning the court to dismiss this outright. And again, anticipating, as the pleading does also say, further motions coming up down the road. Significant events going on in Washington, D.C. just this past week, and also in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Both of them in federal courts, both of them addressing different issues, and yet, both of them related, right? Because it involves the rule of law, the system of due process that we've talked about so much on this broadcast and many others here on Civic Media, the notion that everyone is entitled to their day in court to present evidence, to make arguments, to present your positions before judges who will administer the case, decide the case, and resolve it. Perhaps not in a way that's satisfactory to everyone. That's why we have the appellate process as well. But that system of justice so much on display. Just this past week, locally, right here in Wisconsin and in neighboring states, certainly throughout the United States with respect to Judge Hannah Dugan, but also coming from our nation's capital, right there on Capitol Hill. That building built in 1935, once again, 90 years after it was established there, created there, constructed there, the Supreme Court once again convening to determine whether or not the Constitution has vitality. And if so, how do federal judges interpret all of that? In addition to all of that, we've got some other rule of law news which we're going to talk about. We have not chatted a whole lot about another due process matter involving the Menendez brothers in California. We'll talk about the resentencing and the due process there. And then, indeed, we're going to talk yet again about another civics matter. It seems wonky, but it's no less important than the other things. We're going to talk about disparate impact when it comes to civil rights enforcement in this country, and another executive order that the president issued with respect to the way in which we understand civil rights in America. We'll talk about why his proposal to abandon the notion of disparate impact is also potentially, if it stands, going to undermine our understandings of civil rights in America and the way that litigation proceeds in our civil rights courts. No less important than any of the other matters that we talk about, many other things on our docket in this edition of Amicus, a Law Review. Stay with us for all of that and more.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
I'm as guilty as anybody about this, not talking to real people in person. I'm sorry, I don't believe that texting or video conferencing or any other of that jazz can supplement one-on-one interaction. We as humans need other humans. We need to connect with people. So anyway, that's the public service announcement to start off the week. Get outside and talk to real live humans. You'll feel better.
Catch The Todd Albaugh Show at its new time, weekdays 2 to 4 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Day one, the hardest day, the day you hear.
This is a type of blood cancer.
But day one is just one day. At the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we are here to help you move past day one.
On day 45, I discovered an online community who shared great tips for in-treatment care.
I missed a lot of school during treatment, and LLS helped me keep up.
To learn more and get help on day two, day 28, or any day, please visit lls.org or call 1-800-955-4572.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, coming to you from the studios of Civic Media, joined in the studio with my trusted and outstanding producer, Greg. Together, we're going through these major issues, these major rule of law issues. Important for all of you to note that in this edition of our broadcast, Greg and I are not taking phone calls because, in fact, we're recording this early. We're recording this early here in the studios of Civic Media, returning to the live show next week. But we've got a lot to discuss. So write down your questions, write down your comments, your inquiries, and we will take those in future shows as well. Again, delighted that you're with me and Greg for this program. Promise that we'd begin with what happened just this past week before the United States Supreme Court. Where does this come from? The case, of course, is called Trump versus Washington. It's consolidated with two other matters. They raise the same issues. And here's the way the United States Supreme Court described what it was going to do today. Whether it actually did that is another question. The Supreme Court, it said, is going to hear oral arguments. These, once again, these opportunities for the justices to confront and indeed to quiz the lawyers who represent the parties in front of them about the merits of their positions, basically sparring with them, asking them to justify their positions. That is the oral, because it is spoken, an argument. You'd like to think they're not arguing the same way that you might argue around the dinner time table, but nonetheless, an argument because you've got adversaries in that courtroom. You hear from the petitioner, the people who want something done. You hear from a respondent who presumably is opposed to that action. And indeed, there were three different attorneys, one for the government. He's the Solicitor General of the United States of America, third in position in the U.S. Department of Justice. His name is John Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. And then there were two other attorneys. One of them is the Attorney General from the state of New Jersey, one of the many cases that are consolidated. He spoke at length, hugely compelling presentation, equally compelling by a professor from Georgetown University, also an expert in these areas, again, talking with the justices about what should happen in terms of application of the 14th Amendment. Supreme Court saying that's going to decide whether to issue a partial stay, to suspend, to stop a federal court's preliminary injunction that blocks the Trump administration's executive order called Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship. That's a lot. That's a lot. Lots of language there. I need to unpack that. Basically, the issue, as you well know, is courts around the country, including coming out of New Jersey and other places throughout the districts of our land, have said that the president cannot, in fact, proceed with the executive order that he issued on the first day of his presidency. We'll talk about exactly what he did, explain what that's about, explain what the challenge to that's all about. This past week, the Supreme Court taking up, as it turns out, not the merits of the underlying position advanced by our president that indeed birthright citizenship should be limited in a way that has not been limited at any time in our nation's history, certainly since the passage of the 14th Amendment in 1868, but rather whether or not the decisions by those lower courts to stop the president from going ahead with his description, with his understanding of Amendment 14, whether that should receive nationwide application? Or instead, should it apply only in the specific districts, in the specific courts, in the specific regions in which the judges are acting? The question is, what about national applicability? What about national injunctions? Can a single federal district court judge sitting in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, sitting in the Southern District of Texas, in the Western District of Washington, in the Southern District of New York, you name it, there are 93 of them throughout the country. Can a single federal district court judge issue a stay, which means stop it? Issue an injunction with respect to something going on out there. In this case, it's a presidential directive. And can that order, that judgment, that opinion issued by the federal judge, does that have nationwide applicability? Or is it applicable only in that jurisdiction? The United States Supreme Court this past week spent in excess of two hours debating that issue and spoke only about peeking at the merits. That was the phrase that they repeatedly used this past week, peeking at the merits, the underlying merits of what the president was saying. And so what did the Supreme Court, what were they wrestling with, at least on the surface, and again overlaid by this issue about nationwide injunctions? Well, again, birthright citizenship, of course, refers to the 14th Amendment. It states that individuals, of course, as you know, born within the United States or an area subject to its jurisdiction are granted automatic citizenship. You're born here geographically, you become a citizen. And birthright citizenship, again, acquired in one of two ways. It's fairly simple. You're born within the United States or its territories, or you're being born to U.S. citizens elsewhere in the world, and you are a United States citizen. So on January 20th, President Trump, again, based upon some theories that have been percolating out there, we'll get to a little bit of that, seizing upon those academic theories been banding about for a while, although rejected by the Supreme Court in the latter half of the 19th century, issues this executive order stating that the 14th Amendment was meant to extend a citizenship to everyone born within the United States, but that the 14th Amendment always prohibits from citizenship people who were born in the United States, but not, according to the language of the amendment, subject to its jurisdiction. Things lawyers love, right? What does that language mean, subject to the jurisdiction? Well, according to the president and his lawyers and the people who put together this executive order, if that person's mother was not lawfully present in the United States, father, not a United States citizen, or a lawful permanent resident at the time of the person's birth, or if that person's mother's presence in the United States at the time of the birth was lawful but temporary, for example, visiting under the auspices of a visa waiver program, maybe a student, a work, or a tourist visa. In other words, not permanently here. Again, the father, not a United States citizen. Then that person does not get citizenship. In other words, if your mother fundamentally was unlawfully here at the time she gave birth to you in the territory of the United States, or if your mother was lawfully here, but here pursuant to a temporary order, a temporary visa, you are not a citizen. That is a huge change from how we have understood the 14th Amendment and even before that period of time about citizenship. And that, at least superficially, was what the Supreme Court was addressing. In fact, they decided to focus on whether or not the injunction as to that applies nationwide. I'll tell you more about that when Amicus Law Review continues right after this.
Civic Media.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. Guy Edward Bartkus is the 25-year-old suspect police have now identified in connection with yesterday's car explosion outside a California fertility clinic. They're now going through the writings Bartkus may have left, indicating possible plans for a separate attack later this week. Palm Springs Police Chief Andy Mills speaking moments ago.
We were able to save all of the embryos at this facility. Good guys one, bad guys zero.
A Mexican Navy training ship slammed into New York City's Brooklyn Bridge yesterday. At least two people were killed in the incident and more than a dozen others injured, some seriously. Mayor Eric Adams praised first responders and sailors at the scene.
The coordination was extremely important and it was executed to the best of our ability to minimize any loss of life.
Authorities say the boat lost power before the incident. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
A tough night for Tobias. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, baseball. The Brewers losing again last night, 7-0 to the Twins. Minnesota with 18 hits. The Crew's starting pitcher, Tobias Myers, giving up four runs in the first four innings. Pat Burphy saying the 26-year-old right-hander, struggling with command, is being sent back to the minors.
His slider wasn't great. He threw a lot of balls in the middle of the plate. They were hunting the ball in the upper half. Go someplace different. You have to command the ball a little bit higher in that upper half of the zone. It was a little flat. You got to get the changeup going. You saw it a little bit in the fourth inning. He was a little better with it. But, that's why we're sending him back to AAA. And I love the kid, man. You saw it in game three last year. That's in there. So we got to get back to that.
Another shutout loss and not much else to talk about.
That's it. Get me going. You know when.
Thanks, Bert.
Tough times don't last. Tough people do. Remember that.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. The series wrapping up today from AmFam Field with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly sunny skies for your Sunday. Light north winds and afternoon highs in the upper 60s. Tonight, a few clouds around the area, a northeast breeze, and morning lows in the lower 40s. On Monday, clouds and some showers, highs near 60. It's 57 at our studios.
David was in big trouble with the IRS.
At first, I didn't owe that much, but after this year, it was out of control.
Then David called Get a Tax Lawyer.
Right away, they were like, oh yeah, looks like you're qualified to save.
Get a Tax Lawyer went to work.
Should have called way sooner.
Get a Tax Lawyer has helped thousands like David fight the IRS and get a fresh start.
Call 800-745-3070. That's 800-745-3070.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. After the election of liberal-leaning Justice Janet Prosewitz in 2023, Wisconsin State Assembly and Senate maps were challenged in the Wisconsin Supreme Court and subsequently thrown out as unconstitutional. But justices passed on a challenge to the congressional districts. With April's election of Liberal Justice Susan Crawford, pro-voter groups are trying again for a fairer congressional voting map. In early 2024, the legislature ignored six fairer maps and adopted Democratic Governor Tony Evers' least change compromise map, later allowed to stand by the U.S. Supreme Court. GOP candidates were elected to six of eight congressional districts with only 50% of the statewide vote in 2024. Two challenges were filed May 7th and 8th, one by the Elias Group, contending that the Least Change Directive had no basis in the Wisconsin Constitution, and the second by the Campaign Legal Center, argues that Evers' map ignored traditional redistricting norms, splits too many counties, and didn't equally apportion the districts. A record $100 million was spent by both sides in the recent Wisconsin Supreme Court race. The current margin in the U.S. House is 220 Republicans to 213 Democrats. We've linked to the filings and local reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Jay Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, May is Mental Health Awareness Month. The fabulous farm babe, Pam Yonke, will join us to talk about resources for Wisconsin farmers. Please don't miss it.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review, coming to you from the broadcast stations of Civic Media, joined in the studio by my great producer, Greg. We are recording this in part because there is so much to take care of this week, but also anticipating taking your questions on any of this, your comments, your inquiries in our next broadcast next weekend, which will once again be live. We are talking about one of the two major stories in the rule of law, and that is this major oral argument before the United States Supreme Court just this past week. The justices considering whether federal judges fundamentally, in the end, this is the way they came down on defining what the hearing was all about, whether judges have the power to order temporary pauses, known as injunctions, temporary restraining orders, known as nationwide injunctions. The issue of birthright citizenship formed the backdrop for this, but not the principal show. And indeed, along the way, the justices picked up on the notion of peeking at the merits, peeking kind of underneath the major argument here to figure out whether or not we need to address that other issue to get to this larger issue about the authority of judges to make their decisions nationwide in application. Now, again, the president, when the Supreme Court announced that it was happy, said that he was happy that the justices were taking up the citizenship issue when the Supreme Court announced that it was taking on this issue. An important procedural note here that this is not, once again, among the so-called 65 cases that we've talked a lot about on this broadcast, the things that the Supreme Court's going to be issuing major opinions on in the next 6 weeks or so. We've talked a lot about those cases. They're fully briefed. They're argued. Lots of lawyer documents submitted, memorandums, and oral arguments. This case, like many others with increasing frequency, a part of the court's so-called shadow docket, its emergency application docket. And indeed, this one moved with great speed. The Supreme Court could have once again decided not to take it, could have let the lower courts stand. That is the injunctions against the president's directive, saying you cannot go forward with your executive order, Mr. President, that limits, that restricts birthright citizenship. They decided to take this and take it on a fast track. This is a part of its emergency docket. Indeed, they acknowledge that somewhat during the course of the oral argument as well, describing some of the concerns about not having litigated completely the lower court issue and once again, therefore, having to peek under the covers a bit to figure out whether or not on the merits of the executive order, they should be deciding this larger issue. And yet, the Supreme Court knows it's deciding all this in the wake of history. Along the way, the parties did, in fact, make reference once again to history. 1898, we thought this case, this matter was all settled again. The amendment itself in the wake of the Supreme Court, 1868, about 30 years later, not short, but not long, the Supreme Court decides this issue. They've already told us what this is all about. United States versus Wong Kim Ark. It is still good law in the United States of America. We'll see if it remains that down the road. The court at that time, 1898, finds that a man who was born in San Francisco in this nation, but to Chinese parents, is in fact a citizen. And they affirm at that time the 14th Amendment means what it says and says what it means. So we have got precedent here. And yet we've got disputes. It comes out of this percolation of argument about whether or not, number one, the Wong Kim Ark case should remain precedent, but second, whether or not the whole concept should be revisited. Judges in Washington State and Massachusetts, Maryland, and other places have issued these nationwide pauses on the policy consistent with what the Supreme Court has done in the past. And again, all that history does loom large. We know that the issue comes up. It's been out there for a few decades. It comes out of some academic views. There's a fellow coming from Claremont Institute. His name is Edward Erler. He'd offered some of these theories in some books published in 1997, 2003, to make this a bit shorter in its genesis recently, its resurrection after a century of focus. It has to do with a fellow named John Eastman. You remember him well.
John Eastman. He was the fellow who got himself into a lot of trouble in advocating that the 2020 election was stolen. It was recommended that John Eastman be disbarred over the episode in which he was promoting fake slakes of pro-Trump electors. Recall this well, urging people to believe that Joe Biden had not won the election. Mr. Eastman's still fighting criminal charges that are slowly making their way through the court in Arizona. And still, although he's appealing the withdrawal, the rescission of his law license, it's that fellow who gets the ear of the current president once again in the first term, but again in the second term. And this time in the second term, he gets the ear of the president who issues this executive order saying that, in fact, birthright citizenship is not as broad as you think it is. And in fact, we should go back to this Erler academicism and find that indeed there are carve-outs for it for a variety of invalid and unsupported reasons. But nonetheless, that's where all of this comes from. And today then we get what is supposed to be, again, some wrestling with that issue. It is not that. And the Supreme Court instead focuses again, as I have said, on this issue about whether those lower courts and the decisions in which they have followed precedent and followed the language of the 14th Amendment, whether those injunctions that apply nationwide to districts and jurisdictions beyond the particular jurisdictions and districts of the district court judges, including here in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the Western District of Wisconsin, the Northern District of Illinois, issues that will percolate throughout the nation, how broad should this be? And so you get your Solicitor General, his name is John Sauer. You may recall him as well. He comes back from history, too. John Sauer was the president's former lawyer. John Sauer was the person who previously, in a non-government setting, argued before the Supreme Court just about this time last year, actually April of 2024, argues ultimately successfully on behalf of then private citizen Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, now again president, that a president should be immune from prosecution. This is the attorney who stood before the Supreme Court and said that indeed the Constitution necessitates a finding that presidents are immune from prosecution. And stunningly, shockingly, a majority of the Supreme Court, not without virulent dissent, agreed with him. John Sauer is back. And now he's in government. Now he is appointed by the president. He works for the president. He works for the attorney general, the deputy attorney general. Why? Because they have said he does. And in fact, his office works for you, and he is supposed to represent you. And today, in this time of setting all these things on its head, John Sauer is representing you in a way that is contrary to the interests of many Americans, indeed opposing the views of many district court judges. That's his approach these days as he appears before the Supreme Court. And indeed, he spars. He spars with the justices across the board. He draws, among other things, a distinction between honoring the judgments of courts, the final things entered into a docket, and the opinions, the reasoning, the justification that underlie those things. If you're scratching your head about that, so am I. He engages with Amy Coney Barrett during the course of this oral argument of just this past week. A lot of stories, a lot of accounts about a thing called class certification, the differences between a class of people going ahead and a nationwide injunction, a lot of that along the way. And a lot of this focus upon why it is that the government, your Department of Justice, as voiced by the Solicitor General, is so very much opposed, bright line opposed, to a universal injunction in a case like this, where it's important to know what the Constitution says, and it's important to know in all jurisdictions, in all districts, how we understand that judgment of those districts applied across the board. John Sauer takes a very bright line view, again, on behalf of the government, on behalf of you, candidly, if that is the way we understand his role, that says that the universal injunctions here cannot stand. And indeed, applying his views across the board, these kinds of things should never apply in cases like this. It is significant to contrast that view to the view advanced by the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey. Again, he represents the opposition. He represents those folks who say, you know what? There are times when national injunctions should not stand, but times like this when they should. And it has to do with the nature of the case, the nature of the questions. And this attorney general from the state of New Jersey also spars with the justices about all of this. Along the way, you get Ketanji Brown Jackson sparring again with John Sauer, sparring with the attorney general about this notion of giving relief in class actions to people who are not parties to the case. Does that make sense? What about the situation here where effectively by prosecuting a case in a particular jurisdiction with particular plaintiffs, you're giving relief nationwide? Lots and lots of back and forth on all of that, led by Ketanji Brown Jackson. And along the way, again, some great language coming out of this oral argument. She talks about the argument being offered by the government as being a catch me if you can system promotion, advocacy. And of course, John Sauer pushes back on that. But nonetheless, that's the kind of commonplace language. Ketanji Brown Jackson says, can't we just say that the action is unlawful? Stop doing it. And if a district court judge says it's unlawful, shouldn't the action simply stop? And in a situation like this, where we've got nationwide interests, should that not apply across the board? Lots of back and forth. Along the way, we've got Justice Alito early on asking the question that he has asked before, that Antonin Scalia used to ask on a regular basis talking about standing. He'd often ask, what's it to you? What's it to you? Indeed, Sam Alito raises that in connection with the interests of the parties in a nationwide injunction versus a much more narrow injunction or a temporary restraining order. Justice Kagan weighs in on this, and she says, if you can't enjoin something on a national level, how do you ensure that the law is being enforced? She talks a lot as well with the attorney general coming out of the state of New Jersey about the administrative problems affiliated with this. And indeed, the attorney general talks about the practical difficulties of establishing a split screen, if you will, more than a split screen, saying that in New Jersey and other places, if you begin to carve out exceptions to birthright citizenship, you are causing a whole lot of problems, even between states that, again, administer programs differently, administer the rules and regulations of their states differently. He talks about the practical problems of not having a universal injunction, a universal understanding of what the law means, and describes in great detail the reason why here in this case, a nationwide injunction is appropriate. He concedes along the way in a way that John Sauer does not. It's always helpful during the course of an oral argument if when justices, in this case, or judges before an appellate court or a district court look at you and they say, wouldn't you concede that your position cannot apply in all instances? It's always wise to say, yes, there may be some exceptions. And indeed, from New Jersey, we get just that. The attorney general says, yes, there are times when nationwide injunctions are inapplicable. And he identifies some of those. We talk about specific cases, but he goes on to say here, that's not the situation. He talks about three buckets of situations. Lawyers love to talk about buckets of things, principles and practices, inside theories. He talks about traditional equities, and he says this is what this case is all about, what's fair, what's just to do. He talks about the articles in the Constitution, the Congress, the Article 1 implications. Congress can otherwise authorize things and can interpret the Constitution. He says that's not what's going on here. He talks then about situations where it's really, really important. And then also nationwide injunctions should in fact be endorsed. He talks about these three buckets, and the justices spar with him about all of that and analyze this under the rubrics that he has presented. Justice Alito and others, including Clarence Thomas, who speaks up as well, he speaks first during the course of the oral argument, talking about history and about the applications of the past. When we come back, I'll tell you more about history, what Amy Coney Barrett said once again about historical implications, and about something called an occupational disease. An occupational disease, that coming from the voice and the words of Justice Sam Alito when Amicus, a law review, continues.
Eagle 1490 AM. Keeping you connected to your local community with good news and great conversation. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's a hit. Milwaukee Brewers baseball cards are being shared in several communities across the state. The partnership is with police officers in Green Bay, La Crosse, Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Madison, and meant to be an icebreaker between the cops and kids. Here's Brewers President of Business Operations, Rick Schlesinger.
Eventually want to do it to more than just the major cities. We're trying to get around the state as best we can and to sort of engage with our friends around the state. We're a statewide team. We're not just a Milwaukee team.
So see an officer, ask for your own comic book style baseball cards featuring all your favorite Brewers players. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, along with Greg here in the studios of Civic Media. Necessarily talking about this major, frankly, unanticipated argument as late as a few weeks and months ago before the Supreme Court about what birthright citizenship means. Frankly, not, as it turns out, about what that means, but whether or not judges who are stopping the president from going ahead with his executive order, whether their injunctions apply just in their particular areas or whether those apply nationwide. We've got a lot of adversarial argument for the Supreme Court just this past week. Indeed, there is also tremendous argument from a professor from Georgetown University. She's an expert in these areas who also engages in the same kind of back and forth as do the other lawyers about the merits and demerits of nationwide injunctions. Along the way, it is Sam Alito, Justice Sam Alito, who says, you know what? There's this occupational disease out there. It applies to judges from time to time, in which they say, single judges say, I am right. And I can do whatever I want to do because I know I'm right and the rest of the world has to follow what I'm saying is right. I'm convinced I'm right, Justice Alito says. And therefore, isn't that the problem, he says to the professor and to the attorney general? Isn't that the problem with nationwide universal injunctions? He talks about there being 680 district court judges. And he says, you know what? Sometimes they're wrong. And he's right about that, of course. We recall on this very broadcast, we talked about this major Fourth Circuit opinion of about a month and a half ago coming out of an appeals court there saying, you know what? Judges are not perfect. Appeals courts are not perfect. Justices sometimes get it wrong, but the executive branch also sometimes gets it wrong. That, of course, in that major Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion coming out of the immigration issue, focusing upon recognizing the imperfections of our government in all areas, but also recognizing the importance of how you remedy those checks and balances. And again, arguments before the Supreme Court and indeed balances of powers. And so Justice Alito raising that issue here with the attorneys on all sides. Justice Thomas, as he often does, we recall well the guns cases that he has talked about. Rahimi from just this past term. We've talked a lot about that. Bruin, his focus on the past as a way of understanding contemporary world in which we live and the validity of laws. He talks about a bill of peace. He talks about Equity Rule 48, the high courts of chancery, the tax injunctions, and all kinds of other things out there, some of which are completely applicable. Why? Because you do look back at history. You do look back at some things of the past for precedent, and the opposition to that, the pushback from both New Jersey and also Georgetown is, while those are good starting points, they cannot animate our understanding of how things should work today. Universal injunctions today would be very different from the code of the tax code, for example, in 1925, in other places in the past. 1789, a different type of structure in our government. Therefore, Justice Thomas, the attorney, said, that's an important starting point. You can base things, your decision on that, but that's not the end point. You need to build more generally upon, again, as the attorneys were arguing, the three buckets, traditional equity and
congressional engagement and those cases where the standards need to be clear nationwide because the issue is so very important. And that's the last point, which, of course, however the Supreme Court comes down on this, probably not making a final determination about whether or not the underlying action by the parties litigating against the president's executive order, whether that has merit or not. But if they decide that the injunction does, those injunctions do not extend beyond the particular jurisdictions, that national injunctions, universal injunctions cannot stand, affects the applicability of those cases wildly and opens up the possibility that as the litigation continues, the interpretation given by our president will take hold. That's the reason why that is so significant. The significance of this argument, yes, it is wonky, and yes, it is about the things that lawyers love to talk about when it comes to how you apply the law. But ultimately, it does go to the authority of the president and his unilateral determination, again, contrary to all the history in our nation, that the 14th Amendment no longer means what it says and says what it means. That's what this litigation is ultimately almost always about. It also plainly has implications for many other cases in which federal judges are enjoining and not enjoining, are stopping and not stopping various actions by an executive, not just this president, but other presidents of the past. And across the board, the litigation and the significance of national injunctions, universal stays on these cases cannot be overstated. It is important to note in the end that Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson spoke in the end about the posture of these cases. She said, wants to talk about whether the government continue to do what is clearly unlawful. She talked about the government's obligation to show in litigation that there has been harm to the government by virtue of the injunction that has been entered. What is the harm? Sort of putting Justice Alito's comment, what's it to you, on its head. What is the harm? And is the government not obliged also to show what the harm is in permitting the law as it has stood for time immemorial in our nation? What is the harm to the government in doing that? A lot of focus on what the harm is to the litigants on the other side. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson giving us not the last word, but almost the last word in this oral argument. It is difficult to read exactly what the Supreme Court has said about this. Once again, entirely possible that judges and justices across the board are going to be continuing to wrestle with this. Justices Kavanaugh, Barrett in particular, Amy Coney Barrett, may hold the answer, as she often does. When we come back, we'll talk about more rule of law issues, including another federal courthouse right here in Wisconsin, when Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM, Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Dr. Kristen Lierley, host of the new Dr. Kristen Lierley Show, and artist-actor Steve Segrin joins the program. Now that's how you Monday.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Streaming TV is where it's at. It's not about cutting the cord anymore. It's all about your customized TV options. With the best and cheapest high-speed internet and your own TV subscriptions, we've got your dream TV lineup. Between wired and satellite internet and TV, save money and get more internet speed and better TV today by calling the Whole Home Connect.
800-217-9129. 800-217-9129. 800-217-9129.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. The 25-year-old man who died in a vehicle explosion outside a fertility clinic in Palm Springs yesterday morning is the suspect behind that intentional act of terrorism, police say. FBI identified the man as Guy Edward Bartkus of California, who they say was likely trying to live stream the blast when it happened. Rhino Williams was nearby when it all unfolded.
I saw the car, well, whatever was left over of the car, was on fire in the middle. Debris everywhere. I noticed that the liquor store next door had all the windows blown out.
Authorities also say they're looking at writings Bartkus may have left behind. No embryos or genetic materials were damaged in the attack. The National Transportation Safety Board is looking into a bizarre incident in New York City's East River last night. A Mexican Navy vessel lost power and collided with the Brooklyn Bridge, killing two sailors aboard and injuring several more. Videos show onlookers running for safety. This is ABC News. Trains for the third largest transit system in the country remain at a standstill today, the third day of the New Jersey transit strike. Negotiators were back at the bargaining table again today with rail engineers and their union arguing for pay raises that they say puts them more in line with the wages of similar transit systems in the area. NJ Transit officials say what they're asking for is too steep. Important news for anyone worried about memory loss. The FDA has approved the first blood test to help diagnose Alzheimer's. Neurologist Dr. Leah Kroll of Maimonides Health spoke to ABC News.
Really what this is going to allow us to do is get people that diagnosis faster. And this could not come at a better time because in the last couple of years, we finally have effective treatments for Alzheimer's. So to be able to get people quick.